To the reading of the Des Moines Register for Sunday, March 28th. I'm your reader, Judy. Things are changing very quickly, and IRIS wants to make sure we provide listeners with as much information as we can. In order to do that, we've changed our program schedule completely. This schedule will air statewide on all platforms until further notice. We will also include information about resources in your community during each paper. You'll still hear your Des Moines Register every day at 9 a.m., 6 p.m., and 1 a.m. Please listen closely to the following changes for all other newspapers. The Fort Dodge Messenger will be read at 7 a.m. Monday through Friday. This hour includes readings from the Storm Lake Times and the Webster City Freeman Journal. The Mason City Globe Gazette will be read at 8 a.m. Tuesday through Sunday. Your Des Moines Register will continue to be read from 9 a.m. to noon. The Cedar Rapids Gazette is now read at noon, 7 days a week. The Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier will be read at 1 p.m., Sunday through Friday. The Dubuque Telegraph Herald will be read at 2 p.m., Monday through Friday. The Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil will be read at 3 p.m., Monday through Friday. The Sioux City Journal will be read at 4 p.m., 7 days a week. The Ames Tribune will be read at 5 p.m., Monday through Friday. The Midweek Shopping Cart will be read each Wednesday at 9 p.m. Recordings of all newspapers will be available on our podcast page. Go to iowaradioreading.org, click Listen Now, then click Listen to IRIS Podcasts. The papers are organized by region. Keep yourself safe, and thank you for listening. Now, let's take a look at today's weather. It's going to be mostly sunny today, pleasant in the north and the south. Temperatures are going to range from the mid to high 40s in the eastern portion of the state to the mid to high 50s in the western portion of the state. Winds northwest 10 to 20 miles an hour. Clear tonight. Winds become southwest 3 to 6 miles per hour. Winds becoming stronger tomorrow, but mostly sunny. Here's the first story from the front page of today's Des Moines Register. The prison attack. Namesake city now in mourning. A prison town. Penitentiary is part of Anamosa's fabric of life. Everyone knows someone who works there. As Bill Langdon laid down a concrete angel at the steps of Anamosa State Penitentiary, he gazed up at the hulking structure. He scanned its limestone bricks and wrought iron bars, catching the eye of a prisoner employee who opened the door. "Bill, come on in," she said. And so Langdon, a retired federal agent, entered the state prison, where just a day before two employees were killed in an attack allegedly carried out by two inmates now charged with their murders. Inside, Langdon gave his condolences to those gathered in the lobby, as one by one people stopped by to lay flowers, balloons, and signs of support for prison employees mourning the loss of their co-workers and friends. Langdon's interaction and Anamosa's outpouring of support are emblematic of the prison's impact on the northeast Iowa town of 5,500. It's Anamosa's largest employer, and everyone knows someone who works there, whether a loved one, a neighbor, or a friend of a friend, who each workday enters the nearly 150-year-old behemoth that houses some of Iowa's worst criminals. Besides the prison employees with whom he worked while in law enforcement, Langdon ticked off a few more. A guy on his volleyball team, a woman he bowls with, a good friend. "If you count them up, you probably know 10 to 20 people in there," he said, looking toward the prison. "Whatever you do, from anywhere, even if it's just from the local bar." The prison is part of the fabric of Anamosa, a small city with bars, restaurants, and little shops lining its busy main street. It is the birthplace of famous Iowa painter Grant Wood and home to the National Motorcycle Museum. The city and the prison share history and a name, giving the town recognition it might not otherwise enjoy. The prison gives community members access to reliable, good-paying jobs with benefits, including a state retirement plan. The building is an architectural marvel, and it sits just two blocks off Main Street, surrounded by Anamosa homes and businesses. But it also stands on its own, a fortress that is a medium to maximum security prison. It is closed off to the rest of society. Unless they work there, Anamosa residents really don't know what goes on within those walls. Many have never been inside and never will, since the prison shut down annual public tours in recent years. Tuesday's deadly attack against employees, the first worker fatality since 1975, and to believe to be just the fourth in the prison's nearly 150-year history, attracted TV satellite trucks and dozens of reporters. But while the building sits atop a hill and its battlement contains views from spots across the city, the penitentiary is typically a quiet presence here. "It's a little island in town," said City Administrator Beth Brinks. "I don't really think about it until something like this happens, but it is a dangerous place," she said. Tuesday morning offered a stark and mournful reminder of that danger. Around 10 a.m. Tuesday, two inmates attempting to escape from the prison allegedly attacked and killed a correctional officer, 46-year-old Robert McFarland of Ely, and a registered nurse, 50-year-old Lorena Schulte of Cedar Rapids, authorities said. The employees were trying to stop the long-planned escape of 28-year-old Michael Dutcher and 39-year-old Thomas Woodard when the inmates bludgeoned them with hammers, according to investigators. A third inmate, McKinley Robbie, 57, suffered multiple fractures to his skull as he attempted to give aid to the injured employees. He's expected to survive, authorities said. Dutcher allegedly grabbed prison staff member Lori Mathis, who was nearby when attacks began, held her against her will, and threatened her with her life if she did not cooperate. She was released a short time later, authorities said. "The attack was horrific, an act of pure evil," said Corrections Department Director Beth Skinner, "and set in motion a period of collective mourning across the prison's namesake city. It was a chaotic Tuesday as ambulances and police cars raced down East Main Street in front of Tucker's Tavern, an electrically decorated bar and restaurant where the servers are welcoming and customers are friendly. Later that night, a group of nurses who work at the prison came in to decompress. By Wednesday, things had gone quiet. The lunch rush was not quite as bustling as usual. The weather outside matched the mood inside the tavern. Gray, somber, and just sad. It didn't matter that the victims weren't from Anamosa. With their jobs at the prison, they were part of Anamosa. An attack on prison employees is an attack on the community. When you hear about something like that, you wonder if it's somebody you know, said Leanne Boone, executive director of the Anamosa Chamber of Commerce. But then you think it doesn't matter because we're all community. Either way, it's tragic. The town stood ready to mourn the tragedy. When state officials held a news conference Wednesday, just outside the prison's limestone walls, about 50 people, many from town, showed up to hear what law enforcement officers had to say. When Skinner read the victims' names out loud, someone in the crowd let out an audible sob, a noise that reverberated through the media lines that had formed to learn the details. "The outpouring of support across our state, in our nation, has been truly overwhelming, and we want to thank you," she said. "I call this event a tragedy because that is truly at the heart of what took place yesterday. Two wonderful people had their lives taken from them while they were simply trying to do their jobs here in Anamosa." Anamosa won a bid in 1872 to build Iowa's second state prison, needed as Fort Madison's inmate population outgrew the facility. Next year, the prison will celebrate its 150th anniversary. Anamosa fought for the prison because its leaders recognized the economic benefits that would come should it be selected by the state, said Steve Wendell, who worked as a counselor at the prison for more than 30 years and started the Anamosa State Penitentiary Museum. Since its inception, the prison has been the largest employer in town. Today, it employs 320 people and offers a median salary of $54,400, according to the state employee salary book. A little fewer than half of its employees live in Jones County, of which Anamosa is the county seat. The rest travel in for work, some from as far as Clayton and Blackhawk counties, which in and of itself is the economic benefit seen in few communities across Iowa, Wendell said. But there is also a certain prestige with having a major state facility in your community, he said. Everyone knows Anamosa. It's a prison town. Fort Madison is a prison town. Eldora, you know, from the time I was a kid misbehaving at home and Mom threatened to send me to Eldora, I knew what it was, he said, referring to the state-run school for troubled boys. It took 6 decades to fully build the massive facility, consisting of several buildings whose walls enclosed 13 acres. Its first inmates took a railroad line that ran through the property to a nearby quarry. There they would extract limestone, get back on the rail car, and put the rock in place. The prison was fully constructed using steam power and manpower. No electricity was involved. They literally built the prison around themselves and created something that people look at now and say, "We couldn't do that again," Wendell said. "It was just a marvel of construction," he said. From the outside, the prison looks largely as it did a century ago, save for the street markers and security notices. A handicap accessible ramp and a guard tower painted it so it blends in with the limestone. The prison's Gothic Revival architecture is on full display with wrought iron windows and terrace pillars, decorative cornices placed along the parapet, and the castle-like battlement that marks the front entrance. When it was built, Anamosa State Penitentiary was on the outskirts of town, surrounded mainly by fields. Now the town has surrounded it, with houses just across the street from its main entrance. Despite its massive presence in Anamosa, there is a dichotomy between the prison and the town. What goes on inside is largely a mystery, known only to those who enter its walls to work or to serve a sentence. Wendell attributes that to a measure of time and success. If you look at the newspapers from the early days of the prison, every week they had an update. Who the inmates were coming in, who the inmates were leaving, what they were having to eat. I mean, the community was intensely interested in the prison, he said. But as time passes, and as the institution has established this long, long record of stability and tranquility, then you kind of are forgotten a little bit, you know? And that just comes or goes with time and with doing a good job, you know? People assume that things will continue that way forever and ever and ever. Yet the inmates regularly make a mark on the town. Some are employed by Iowa Prison Industries, where they are most known for making vehicle license plates. Inmates are the sole supplier of Anamosa's street signs, said Brinks, the city administrator. A handful work with the street department to mow and trim and to plant the flower pots that line Main Street. Each year, 2 inmates work at the water waste plant as apprentices to gain certification so they can find employment when they're released. It's hard because last year we didn't get to do anything with them because of the coronavirus pandemic, Brink said. It's nice to have the extra help, but it's also nice we can be part of their rehabilitation. Beyond her interaction with those few inmates, Brink said she generally is unaware of what's going on there. That's one of the reasons why Wendell and a partner opened the museum, to showcase the prison's rich history and give people an inside look at daily life in prison. The museum includes information on prison architecture and the prison's most famous inmate, the serial killer John Wayne Gacy, served time there. It also has a mock cell that is a replica of an original. The museum is located outside of the secure facility in what was once a cheese factory where inmates served as apprentices to make products that supplied Anamosa and other state prisons. The museum is temporarily closed due to the pandemic, but the prison itself is now taking up some more space in the residents' hearts and minds. There will be months, perhaps years, of investigations into what went wrong on Tuesday. Prison officials have vowed to examine their policies and procedures around inmates' access to tools. There will be court proceedings against the suspects, and there will be a long period of mourning for the victims. But if history is any indication, things will quiet down and go back to the space where the prison and the town coexist, synonymous with each other, but largely existing in their own realities. Unless, of course, a loved one, neighbor, or friend of a friend works inside. For the GOP, visits show caucuses are on. Early drop-ins reinforce Iowa retains leadoff role. Mike Pompeo rattled off a list of his accomplishments as U.S. Secretary of State, under former President Donald Trump, touted his Midwest roots, and took nearly an hour of questions from a room full of eager Iowa Republicans. "We put America first, and we got it right," he told the group of about 100 people who sipped coffee and finished plates of eggs and toast at the Machine Shed restaurant in Urbandale Friday. It was part of Pompeo's two-day swing through Iowa to help support the party in a state where Republicans nearly swept the board in the last election cycle, and no major candidates have yet announced their intentions for the next one. The subtext of his visit, however, is not 2022, but 2024. Pompeo has hinted at a possible run for president, and his early forays into Iowa are yet another data point signaling the Republican presidential show or shadow primary has already begun. "I see a lot of cameras in the back. I think there's going to be some big announcement," Pompeo joked, alluding to as much. "We're in Iowa and all." Two other potential contenders, GOP Senator Rick Scott of Florida and Tim Scott of South Carolina, have also announced trips to Iowa next month. Others, like former UN Ambassador Nikki Haley, visited the state to help Republicans campaign late last year. These individuals are coming in to party build. They're coming in to help other Republicans. And you know, let's face it, they're coming in to, I wouldn't say test the waters, but to introduce themselves to Iowans, said Republican Party of Iowa Chairman Jeff Kaufman. "And listen, the more that come in here, the better off we are." The Democrats' botched handling of the 2020 Iowa caucuses touched off a renewed national debate over the presidential nominating process and Iowa's place in it. But Iowa Republicans say the early visits from national political leaders help reinforce their expectation that they, at least, will hold the nation's first caucus again in 2024, regardless of what Democrats do. "I cannot think of a reason that would derail the Republican process, even if the Democrats opt not to have a caucus," said Iowa Republican operative Eric Wilson. "I don't know why we would be dependent on what the Democrats choose to do with their nomination process." Democrats, both nationally and some in Iowa, argue the overwhelmingly white state of Iowa and its convoluted caucus process doesn't represent the party's goals of diversity and inclusion. Republicans, who use a simpler caucus process than Democrats, have not raised such concerns. Kaufman said he has yet to hear of any rumblings within the National Republican Party about rearranging the nominating calendar, though they may come yet. "We've already heard rumors of several other would-be presidential candidates, or rumored presidential candidates, that are planning visits in the near future," said Iowa Republican operative Luke Martz. "The Iowa caucuses are on, and we hope the Democrats join us." After breakfast with the Westside Conservative Club, Pompeo planned a meeting with the Bull Moose Club in downtown Des Moines with Terry Branston, the former Iowa governor and former U.S. ambassador to China. The day before, Pompeo met with the Potawatomi Republicans at an event in Council Bluffs. Pompeo, who is a U.S. representative for the state of Kansas and the director of the Central Intelligence Agency before coming Secretary of State, previously was in Iowa last summer to speak at the Family Leadership Summit hosted by the Family Leader, a Christian conservative advocacy group. He's among a handful of Republicans who found reasons to travel to Iowa last year, including Tim Scott, Haley, Senator Tom Cotton of Arkansas, and South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem. Former Vice President Mike Pence has also a frequent visitor to Iowa while serving in the Trump administration. Rick Scott, who is also the chairman of the National Republican Senatorial Committee, will be in Cedar Rapids April 1st for an event organized by the Republican Party of Iowa. And Tim Scott will return to speak at a party event in Davenport April 15th. According to Des Moines Register data, a handful of potential candidates, Mike Huckabee, Tim Pawlenty, Ron Paul, Rick Santorum, and Sarah Palin, held a dozen events across the state in 2009, just after Democrat Barack Obama had taken office for his first term. But most of those events were held late in the year, during the fall and winter. Republican visits ramped up dramatically in 2010 when they made 123 separate appearances, and the caucus cycle hit its peak in 2011 when Republicans made more than 1,000 Iowa appearances ahead of the January 2012 caucuses. Would-be candidates followed a similar schedule at the outset of the 2016 cycle, as Republicans made their first visits to the state in May of 2013. Democrats, eager to take on Trump after his surprise victory in 2016, began arriving in Iowa at the end of February 2017, holding 63 events throughout that year. By the time caucus day rolled around, Democrats had made roughly 2,600 appearances in the state. The visits already underway this year underscore the political inertia that has, for decades, helped keep Iowa at the front of the presidential nominating calendar. Until the political world settles on and accepts an alternative, Iowa remains the place for presidential aspirants to test their appeal and grow their name recognition. "They always say the proof is in the pudding," Kaufman said, "and I can sit here and preach all I want about first in the nation, but if we've got our top national leaders coming into this state, in some cases this being their first step in the process, that speaks louder than anything I can say." Even as potential candidates begin making early moves in Iowa, Trump's shadow looms. At the Conservative Political Action Conference in February, he continued to falsely claim he won the 2020 election and teased a 2024 campaign, saying, "I may even decide to beat them for a third time." Trump remains popular among Iowa Republicans, who voted to send him back to the White House by an 8% point margin. According to a March Des Moines Register MediaCom Iowa poll, 89% of Iowa Republicans view him favorably. And at CPAC in February, a straw poll showed him dominating a field of potential candidates. Trump won easily, earning 55% of the vote. At 21%, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis was the only other Republican to crack into double digits. But Kaufman said he doesn't believe politicians can run the risk of alienating Trump or his supporters simply by showing up in Iowa. "In my conversations with many of these leaders, and I've had conversations with many of them, not one time did I hear one of these national leaders or a member of their team actually say anything negative or even imply anything negative toward the former president," he said. "So no, I don't think there's any risk whatsoever." But some Republicans say they're ready to move on from Trump. Longtime Iowa operative Doug Gross said in January, after the U.S. Capitol attack on January 6th, that he would personally try to block Trump's rise in Iowa if he were to run again. "I'm going to dedicate my efforts to try to make sure that Trump finds Iowa as his St. Helena, that it's an island he'll be on that he never comes back from," he said, referencing Napoleon Bonaparte's place of exile and death. In the meantime, politicians with relatively low national profiles can help raise their name recognition and build relationships with key activists. "Maybe these people don't run. Maybe they do," Mart said. "But until they make the decision, it's not a bad idea to invest the time in Iowa." Even as Iowa Republicans project confidence about their 2024 caucuses, they acknowledge that challenges could still arise and could come from unexpected places. So far, Nevada Democrats have made the most concerted push to surpass Iowa on the nominating calendar. The state legislature introduced a bill that calls for the state to switch from a caucus to a primary and move its date earlier in January in a specific bid to be first. But the legislation ignores laws on the books in Iowa and New Hampshire that require the states to hold the first caucus and first primary respectively, and that give wide latitude to state leaders to set their dates accordingly. Kaufman said his counterpart in Nevada State's Republican Party has assured him he would not support the effort, and he said other threats to Iowa's caucuses have yet to materialize on the Republican side. "I have heard nothing at this point of any kind of official type of challenge to Iowa being first in the nation in the Republican National Committee," he said. "That doesn't necessarily mean it will not come. In fact, I fully expect that I'm going to have to explain myself and explain the state and explain the justification. I feel very, very comfortable building on the last two caucuses." Even if the National Party were to make changes, he and others say there is very little likelihood Iowa's Republican governor and Republican-controlled legislature would move to change the state law. I can't see anything in the sentiment of our legislators or our state leaders to change the timing of the Iowa caucuses, Wilson said. The state law says that we're first, and I think everyone's inclination is to keep us first. Kaufman said he sought another term as Republican Party of Iowa chairman in January, in part because he felt compelled to help protect the caucuses. There is nothing more important to me than remaining first in the nation, he said. And I'll be honest with you, I can think of very little I won't do within the confines of the law in order for us to keep it. Big tech's influence draws pushback. Activists, lawmakers seek to rein in companies. New York State Senator Michael Gianaris was ecstatic when Amazon named Long Island City in 2018 as a frontrunner for its new headquarters, a project that would bring 25,000 jobs and $2.5 billion in construction spending to his district in Queens. But his support faded quickly when he learned that state and city leaders had promised one of the world's richest companies tax breaks worth $3 billion in secretive negotiations. A public backlash led Amazon to cancel the investment altogether. But to Gianaris, the episode still illuminated the massive power of tech companies that dominate their industries, overwhelm traditional businesses, and use that leverage to expand their reach even further. Consumer activists, small business owners, and state lawmakers across the U.S. are increasingly calling for measures to rein in companies such as Amazon, Apple, Facebook, and Google that wield influence over so much of everyday life. Normally, that task would fall to the federal government, but while the Justice Department and the Federal Trade Commission have filed major antitrust actions against Google and Facebook, both with widespread state support, Congress remains stalled when it comes to making new laws related to big tech. So scores of so-called techlash bills are being debated in dozens of state houses where lawmakers of both major parties are proposing new regulations related to antitrust, consumer privacy, app store fees, and taxes on digital ad sales. Republican lawmakers are also pushing back against what they claim, without evidence, is an attempt to stifle conservative voices on social media. Gianaris, a Democrat, is pushing a landmark antitrust bill in the New York legislature. It would set a new legal antitrust standard, abuse of dominance, and allow class action lawsuits under state laws. Our antitrust laws have atrophied, and they're not equipped to handle the 21st century and anti-competitive practices, he said. The traditional antitrust enforcement doesn't work because big tech has become too big and too powerful. Tech companies aren't content to play defense. Their lobbyists are pushing state lawmakers to oppose restrictions they deem onerous. In other words, the companies are working to write their own, more favorable bills. On many issues, they would also prefer federal legislation over a patchwork of state laws. Of particular concern to two of the biggest companies is legislation being considered in several state houses that would limit the ability of Apple and Google to collect large shares of the consumer transactions in their app stores. Critics say the two leading U.S. smartphone companies use their position as app gatekeepers to fatten their profits with fees and undermine rivals that compete against their own music, video, and other services. Leading the pushback are companies such as Epic, which owns the popular Fortnite video game, Spotify, and Match.com. They want to force Apple and Google to let them keep the proceeds from subscriptions and in-app sales without taking a cut. In an attempt to fend off potential government reforms, Apple last year cut in half its standard 30% commission on app purchases for most developers. Google recently followed suit with cuts set to take effect in July. State Representative Regina Cobb, a Republican sponsoring app store legislation in Arizona, said app makers and their customers are being held hostage. That's a Chicago-style mafia kind of thing. You pay us 30% or you don't get to play. We'll take you off of our platform. Your company's done, Cobb said. Similar legislation is being considered in Georgia, Massachusetts, Minnesota, and Wisconsin. App Store legislation in North Dakota died in February following intense lobbying by both sides. Apple chief privacy engineer Eric Neusenschwander spoke out against the bill, saying it threatens to destroy iPhones as you know it by requiring changes that would undermine privacy and security. Moves by California, Nevada, and Virginia to enact their own comprehensive data privacy laws have emboldened others to follow suit. In Oklahoma, a bipartisan bill would require companies to obtain prior consent before collecting and selling the data of state residents. In Florida, legislation would give consumers ownership of the digital information companies collect through their spending, social interactions, news habits, and travel. The Florida bill would require companies to divulge what data they are gathering, force them to delete it upon consumer request, and prohibit them from sharing or selling it when told not to. They could be sued if they don't comply. One of its sponsors, Republican State Representative Fiona McFarland, said it's a response to the omnipresent collection, sharing, and selling of personal information. It's everything these apps on our phones, to payment exchanges, to calendars, she said. Facebook says it supports some online privacy laws and provides as much input as possible while bills are being written. The Internet Association, the tech industry's major trade group representing Amazon, Facebook, Google, and dozens of other tech companies, declined to comment. In California, a bill dubbed the Anti-Eavesdropping Law seeks to limit how smart speakers can potentially intrude into private lives. Its sponsor, Republican Assemblyman Jordan Cunningham, unplugged a smart device in his bedroom 6 months ago after it lit up unprompted. The only thing stopping all of these recordings from being in the hands of government is one search warrant, he said. These things are getting hacked all the time, so you know your data can end up in Russia. His bill would extend existing limitations on smart televisions and would require companies such as Amazon, which markets Echo smart speakers, to obtain permission before they can record, transcribe, or sell information from any conversation. The company's disruption of traditional businesses and the tax revenue they once provided for governments also hasn't gone unnoticed. Maryland lawmakers this year overrode a veto from Republican Governor Larry Hogan to create a first-in-the-nation law that taxes digital advertising. The measure, initially approved last year, has prompted a number of other states, including Connecticut, Indiana, Massachusetts, Montana, and New York, to consider similar legislation. Supporters say the law seeks to modernize the state's tax system and make thriving tech companies pay their fair share. It would assess the tax on revenue tech companies make on digital advertisements within the state, raising an estimated $250 million a year for education. Companies like Amazon, Facebook, and Google have seen their profits drastically increase during the COVID-19 pandemic, while our Main Street businesses are struggling to keep up, said Maryland State President Bill Ferguson, a Democrat who sponsored the measure. Opponents have challenged the law in federal court and say it violates the Internet Tax Freedom Act, which prohibits states from imposing multiple and discriminatory taxes on electronic commerce. Sticky bombs, the latest weapon to wreak havoc in Afghanistan. Sticky bombs slapped onto cars trapped in Kabul's chaotic traffic are the latest weapons terrorizing Afghans in the increasingly lawless nation as Washington searches for a responsible exit after decades of war. The primitive devices, sometimes made in mechanics workshops for little money, are used by militants, criminals, or those trying to settle personal scores. Over the past year, one or more cars have been exploded in Kabul almost every day, and residents are terrified. The administration of President Joe Biden has alternated between coaxing and sharp words, even offering a ready-made peace proposal to hurry the Taliban and the Afghan government towards an end to the conflict. In the Afghan capital last week, U.S. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin said America wanted a responsible end to Afghans' relentless war. But in the meantime, violence is escalating and taking the occasional new twist, such as the sticky bombs. Kabul, a city traumatized by war, has been the scene of many suicide bombings and shooting attacks, but the heavy use of sticky bombs is relatively new, said former Interior Minister Masoud Andarabi. What is new is that they have created a simple model, he said, noting that sticky bombs are easy to make for about $25. Some victims are targeted, while others appear to have been chosen at random, with the aim of terrorizing entire populations, Andarabi said. One motive appears to be to undermine faith in peace efforts among ordinary Afghans, with the Taliban and the government blaming each other for the chaos. The campaign has had an impact, leaving motorists navigating Kabul's chaotic traffic, wondering if the nearby car might explode or whether a beggar weaving through the traffic might be carrying a sticky bomb. Typically, a sticky bomb consists of explosives packed in a small box, a magnet attached to the box, and a mobile phone. The bomb maker programs a number into the phone and dials it, with the last digit setting off the blast once he is clear of the targeted car. Tactics vary, say security forces. Occasionally, a small child begging for money will be used to distract the driver while the bomber sticks the small box under the wheel well. A new ruse is to drop the sticky bomb from inside a hole cut near the gear shift of the attacker's vehicle as the target vehicle approaches from behind. There is no shortage of recruits from the city's poor, who make up roughly two-thirds of Afghanistan's 35 million people. According to the World Bank, 72% of Afghans' 35 million people live on roughly $1.90 a day, and unemployment is around 30%. UN Commission urges equality for women in decision-making. The UN's premier global body fighting for gender equality called for a sharp increase of women in global decision-making in a hotly debated final document adopted Friday night that saw continuing pushback against women's rights and a refusal to address issues of gender identity. The Commission on the Status of Women reaffirmed the blueprint to achieve gender equality adopted 25 years ago at the Beijing Women's Conference and shone a spotlight on several major issues today, including the imbalance of power between men and women in public life and the growing effects of violence against women and girls in the digital world. Diplomats were negotiating until almost the last minute over language on women human rights defenders, gender-based violence, and earlier on reproductive and sexual health and rights. Some Western nations sought unsuccessfully to get the Commission to recognize gender nonconforming and transgender women. The closest they got was a reference to women and girls who experience multiple and intersecting forms of discrimination and face diverse situations and conditions. The European Union said it would have liked to see more ambitious language in the 23-page document, stressing that the systemic attempts by some delegations to derail the process and question international commitments and obligations on gender equality show that the pushback against women's rights continue. Shannon Kowalski, Director of Advocacy and Policy for the International Women's Health Coalition, said at a briefing earlier Friday that this year, Russia has been very vocal and on the front lines in pushing for language that is often regressing and that seeks to deny women and girls their rights. The Holy See often joined its position, and Saudi Arabia, Iran, and Cuba were also vocal opponents on many issues, she said, while China opposed any reference to women human rights defenders. Russia played an exceptionally disruptive role in the negotiations, an EU diplomat said. Today's low common denominator result demonstrates that a pushback against women's rights continues at the UN and that Russia is doing all it can to undermine progress on the issue. The diplomat spoke on condition of anonymity because of the sensitivity of private discussions. The agreed conclusions were negotiated by the 193 UN member nations and adopted by consensus by the Commission's 45 members at the end of a two-week meeting. The UN Women's Agency said more than 25,000 members of civil society registered to participate in the partly in-person but mainly virtual meeting that saw 200 side events led by member states and more than 700 events by civil society representatives. After Ambassador Mayor Margaron, the Commissioner's chair, banged the gavel signifying consensus, about 24 countries spoke. Saudi Arabia stressed that any reference to gender means women and men, and to marriage as between men and women. China said it would not join consensus on the role of women human rights defenders. In the document, the Commission supports the important role of civil society in promoting and protecting the human rights and freedoms of all women, including women human rights defenders. UN Women Executive Director Phumzile Malombo-Nguka said the areas in the outcome document do not please everybody, and the conclusions could have been more ambitious, and the recommendations even bolder and decisive. She urged member states to use the recommendations as a building block and to outperform what is contained in these agreed conclusions. She said next week's mainly virtual gender equality forum in Mexico City, another follow-up to the 1995 Beijing conference, will take forward what we have learned from the discussions of this commission and look at how we can take concrete actions. Malombo-Nguka said the conclusions contribute to important advances on women's participation in public life, the main focus of the meeting, along with tackling violence against women, which increased during last year's COVID-19 pandemic. The commission recognized that despite some progress, women have a long road to reach equality with men in elections or appointments to decision-making bodies and administrative posts, she said. And it recognized that temporary special measures, including quotas, substantially contribute to increasing women's representation in national and local legislatures, and called on all governments to set specific targets and timelines to achieve the goal of 50-50 gender balance in elected positions. On violence against women in the digital world, Malombo-Nguka said the commission noted the lack of preventative measures and remedies. She said member states should take action to encourage women's digital participation and protect them, including from cyberstalking and cyberbullying. The Beijing Declaration and platform, approved by 189 countries in 1995, called for bold action in 12 areas to achieve gender equality, including combating poverty and gender-based violence, ensuring all girls get an education, and putting women at top levels of business and government, as well as at peacemaking tables. It also said, for the first time in a UN document, that women's human rights include the right to control and to decide on matters relating to their sexuality, including their sexual and reproductive health, free of discrimination, coercion, and violence. In Friday's outcome document, the Commission urges governments at all levels to ensure universal access to sexual and reproductive health and reproductive rights. It also urges governments to provide information on sexual and reproductive health and HIV prevention, gender equality, and women's empowerment to adolescent boys and girls and young women and men, with appropriate direction and guidance from parents and legal guardians. Study: Shots Safe in Pregnancy. Vaccine protects mom, likely their babies too. COVID-19 vaccines are extremely effective at protecting pregnant women and likely provide protection for their babies as well, according to a new study. The research, published Thursday in the American Journal of Obstetrics and Gynecology, examined 131 vaccine recipients, including 84 who were pregnant, 31 who were breastfeeding, and 16 who weren't pregnant as a control group. Early studies suggested the COVID-19 vaccines from Pfizer, BioNTech, and Moderna would be safe and effective, but this is the largest study to date looking at the immune responses of pregnant and lactating women to vaccination. Large-scale clinical trials intentionally excluded pregnant women, leaving them to wonder whether to get the shots or not. As a maternal fetal medicine doctor, Jacqueline Parcham had no real doubts she'd get vaccinated, But as a 31-week pregnant woman in mid-December, the first week the shots were offered, she admits she felt a little apprehensive. "I'm a scientist first, and we didn't have the data," said Parcham, who was immediately eligible for vaccination as a healthcare worker at the University of Texas Health Center at Houston. Still, she had seen the damage COVID-19 could cause to her pregnant patients, increasing their risk for hospitalization, intensive care, and mechanical ventilation. Based on the performance of other vaccines, she was confident the Pfizer, BioNTech, and Moderna's 95% effectiveness rates would likely be true for her as well. She talked with scientist friends, and none could come up with a biologically plausible way the vaccine could harm her future child, and she anticipated the shots would stimulate her body to make antibodies that could protect her son against COVID-19 in his first months of life. The benefits of vaccination, the relief of anxiety, every effective protection from a potential life-threatening infection, and then the benefits of passive immunization to my baby. At the time, we didn't have that data, but it's science. We know how vaccines work, she said. I feel very confident of that. Her conviction has been borne out by recent research, including the newest study. In terms of safety data, more than 60,000 pregnant women have now signed up for the government's V-Safe program, which monitors people who have received a COVID-19 vaccine for safety issues. As of the latest V-Safe report in February, there was no safety concerns flagged. Among a smaller group of pregnant women, including Parcham, who agreed to be followed during and after their pregnancy, the number of pregnancy complications, such as miscarriage, gestational diabetes, were comparable between the vaccinated and the unvaccinated. A new study conducted at Massachusetts General Hospital and Brigham and Women's Hospital, both in Boston, found pregnant and nursing women received as much protection from vaccines as non-pregnant women, and more protection than they would get from an infection with the virus that causes COVID-19. Both the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines are based on a relatively new vaccine technology known as mRNA, which hadn't been tested in pregnant women, so there were questions about how much protection they would provide. There was no indication that their babies were harmed in any way by the shots, said co-authors Galit Alter and Andrea Edlow, and the side effect profiles were virtually identical between pregnant and non-pregnant women. Plus, the babies born to mothers vaccinated in pregnancy had antibodies to COVID-19. Although it's not clear what antibody levels are protective against disease, they likely had enough to be protected for at least some time, Alter and Edlow said in a conference call. The two mRNA vaccines are very similar, but the study did pick up a difference. Moderna's two-shot regime appeared to generate more of a certain type of antibody called IgA than Pfizer's, though it's not clear whether that difference matters, they said. Fortunately, now we feel we can say it does work to induce an antibody response, Edlow said. That part of the counseling is much easier when you have actual data instead of saying, we think this will work for you. It feels much more comfortable to say to patients, actually, this has been studied and we can say that it's effective. Their study wasn't the definitive clinical trial some pregnant women have been waiting for, but it's pretty close, other OBGYNs said. It certainly is exciting, and it's what personally I was hoping for. I'm feeling good about it, said Dr. Laura E. Riley, a maternal and fetal medicine specialist and chair of the Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology at Weill Cornell Medicine in New York, who has launched similar research. Riley, Edlow, Alter, and other obstetricians were critical of COVID-19 vaccine makers for not including pregnant women in their clinical trials, or at least starting clinical trials in pregnant women once they confirmed the safety of the shots. We could have gotten this information a heck of a lot sooner, but clearly you can't wait forever in the midst of a pandemic, Riley said, explaining why she encouraged her patients to get vaccinated before all the data was available. That added a little bit of tension to the whole situation. Pfizer is conducting a vaccine trial of 4,000 pregnant women, which should be completed late this year. Now it's time to think about how we could have done things differently to not leave these groups out of the protection and the assurance that it was going to be safe and work well in their populations, said Dr. Sally Permar, chair of pediatrics at Weill Cornell Medicine and New York Presbyterian Comiskey Children's Hospital. There's no biological reason why the mRNA vaccines would impact fertility, she said. Plenty of people have gotten the vaccine and gotten pregnant afterward, Pimar said. We really don't think the vaccine is going anywhere other than the muscle where it's injected into and the local lymph nodes where it stimulates the immune response. Como probe to include COVID-19 tests for family. The impeachment investigation into New York Governor Andrew Cuomo is expanding to examine if the governor unlawfully used his office to provide his family members with special access to scarce coronavirus tests a year ago, a state lawmaker said. The Office of Attorney General Letitia James, Cuomo's fellow Democrat, issued a statement Thursday urging New York's Joint Commission on Public Ethics to investigate the alleged preferential testing after reports were published in the Times Union of Albany, the New York Times, and the Washington Post. The recent reports alleging there was preferential treatment given for COVID-19 testing are troubling, the statement read. While we do not have jurisdiction to investigate this matter, it's imperative that J. Cope look into it immediately. Walt McCure, a spokesman for the Ethics Commission, said the commission could not comment on anything that is or might be investigative matter. The impeachment's investigation's primary focus remains on allegations of sexual harassment against Cuomo, as well as reports that his administration intentionally underreported virus deaths at nursing homes and glazed over bridge safety concerns. But the alleged preferential testing will be explored, Assembly Judiciary Committee Chair Chuck Levine said. Members of Cuomo's family, including his brother, CNN journalist Chris Cuomo, his mother, and at least one of his three sisters, were tested by top health department officials, some of them several times, according to the Times Union of Albany. The testing of people closely tied to the governor was carried out by high-ranking state health officials, the New York Times reported. It mostly happened in March of 2020. The newspaper cited multiple people with direct knowledge of the testing, but did not identify them. Rich Ezzaparardi, a spokesman for the Cuomo, did not deny that the administration had extended special treatment to people close to the governor, but sought to dispute the notion. The governor's office didn't provide responses to a list of questions from the Associated Press, including whether the governor disputes these reports. In the early days of this pandemic, when there was a heavy emphasis on contact tracing, we were absolutely going above and beyond to get people tested, as Parodi said in a statement, adding that the effort included, in some instances, going to people's homes and door-to-door in places like New Rochelle to take samples from those believed to have been exposed to COVID in order to identify cases and to prevent others from developing the disease. The state assembly is conducting the investigation into whether there are grounds to impeach the governor. It has hired a Manhattan law firm to lead the probe looking into whether Cuomo used his office to sexually harass or assault female employees, unlawfully withheld the real nursing home death count, covered up structural bolt issues in a state bridge that opened in 2017 to replace the former Tappan Zee Bridge, or provided preferential testing. Israelis mark Passover, enjoy freedom from virus. A year ago, Giordana Grego's parents spent Passover at home in Israel, alone but grateful that they had escaped the worst of the pandemic in Italy. This year, the whole family will get together to mark the Jewish feast of liberation and deliverance from the pandemic. Israel has vaccinated over half its population of 9.3 million. And as coronavirus infections have plummeted, authorities have allowed restaurants, hotels, museums, and theaters to reopen. Up to 20 people can now gather indoors. It's a stark turnaround from last year, when Israel was in the first of three nationwide lockdowns, with businesses shuttered, checkpoints set up on empty roads, and people confined to their homes. Many could only see their elderly relatives on video calls. For us in Israel, really celebrating the festivity of freedom definitely has a whole different meaning this year after what we experienced, said Grego, who immigrated to Israel from Italy. It's amazing that this year we're able to celebrate together, also considering that in Italy, everybody is still under lockdown. Passover is the Jewish holiday, the biblical Israelites' liberation from slavery in Egypt after a series of divine plagues. The week-long springtime festival started Saturday night with the highly ritualized Seder meal when the Exodus story is retold. It's a Thanksgiving-like atmosphere with family, friends, feasting, and four cups of wine. Government-imposed restrictions forced the closure of synagogues and limited movement and assembly to slow the virus spread. Some conducted the ritual meal with their nuclear family, others over video conference, while an unfortunate few held the Seder in solitude. Another lockdown was imposed over the Jewish high holidays in September, again preventing family gatherings, and a third came earlier this year with the emergence of more contagious variants of the virus. By the third lockdown, Israel had launched one of the most successful inoculation campaigns in the world after the government secured millions of doses from Pfizer and Moderna. Israel has now vaccinated more than 80% of its adult population. It's too early to say that Israel's coronavirus crisis is over, as new variants could emerge that are resistant to the vaccines. The vaccination campaign in the Israeli-occupied West Bank and Gaza have been slow to get off the ground, with Israel facing criticism for not sharing more of its supplies. Israel has vaccinated over 100,000 Palestinian laborers who work in Israel and West Bank settlements, and has sent a couple thousand doses to the Palestinian Authority. The Palestinians have imported more than 130,000 doses on their own, but it could be several months before shots are available for the vast majority of the nearly 5 million Palestinians in the territories. Experts say that could pose a risk to Israel's own public health efforts. For now, however, Israelis are enjoying what feels like a post-pandemic reality, lending special significance to Passover. Many want the bathroom use restriction. 80% of Republicans favor it, 71% of Democrats oppose. More Iowans favor than oppose requiring public school students to use bathrooms that correspond with their birth-assigned gender, regardless of current gender identity, the latest Des Moines Register MediaCom Iowa poll found. The poll, conducted by Seltzer & Company, found 47% of Iowans favor such a rule, 42% oppose the requirement, and 11% are not sure. The poll sampled 775 Iowans age 18 or older and has a margin of error of plus or minus 3.5 percentage points. Poll responded, Eric T. Gruntenhus, a Republican, agrees with restricting bathroom use to one's birth-assigned gender. God gave you certain parts, and those are the parts you're supposed to live with, said T. Gruntenhus, 57, of Larchwood. He said he's concerned that allowing students to use restrooms that don't correspond to their gender at birth would be just asking for trouble. Teenagers, in particular, have surging hormones, and allowing students to use bathrooms unaligned with their birth gender would lead to them getting picked on, he said. Neither national nor local authorities have reported any problems with allowing people to use the restrooms that match their identities. Poll respondent Tracy Harrison, 57, a Democrat from Clinton, said she understands concerns parents may have about a student born male but identifying as a woman using the same restroom as their daughters, for example. But ultimately, people must support and accept each other, she said. Speaking generally, there's already a stirring of hate in this country that's unbelievable, Harrison said. She hoped people would learn to get along and be compassionate toward each other. These poor kids are being ostracized at school. They probably can't go to church. They can't function as a human being because they're too busy trying to hide their gender and who they truly are, which is heartbreaking for any human being, she said. Iowa Republicans ran a bill this legislative session requiring people in Iowa to use bathrooms that correspond with the sex listed on their birth certificate. It passed through a Senate subcommittee, a first for such a bill in Iowa after similar legislation had been proposed for several years. But the bill failed to proceed further. And that does it for the first hour of the Register on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Up next, we'll give a shout out to all our listeners who are celebrating a birthday today. I'm your reader, Judy. Thanks for listening.